If you want to understand why Iraq is such a mess, you need some historical perspective. At least that's the view of Margaret Macmillan, author of the book Paris 1919. When the First World War ended, European and American leaders met in France to hammer out a peace accord, what's known today as the Versailles Treaty. Europe got most of the attention, but these leaders also decided to carve up the old Ottoman Empire that once ruled the Middle East.
So the question of what happened to all those Arab lands was up. And the big powers, who were thinking, I think, still very much in a 19th century, rather imperialist way, thought that they could simply dispose of the Middle East to suit themselves. And they made what were really rather offhand and casual decisions, which shaped the Middle East as we know it and laid the seeds for much of the conflict that we have there today.
We ought to talk a little bit about what the structure was prior to 1919. You talk about the Ottoman Empire. They chose badly toward the end of the war in aligning themselves with the Germans.
The Ottoman Empire sided, of course, with Germany and Austria-Hungary, and that probably was a mistake, although they thought at the time that they'd made the right decision. By the end of the First World War, it was clear that they were no longer going to be able to hang on to very many of their territories, except for the heartland in what became Turkey. And the British and the French, who had been expecting the disappearance of the Ottoman Empire even before the war started, took the opportunity during the war to do a quiet little deal, a secret deal, in fact, among themselves, to divide up the Arab territories of the Ottoman Empire. And so the deal, it was called Sykes-Picot after the two men who signed it. The deal was roughly that the French would get what became Lebanon and Syria, and the British would get what became Iraq and Palestine. The Arabs weren't consulted. Nobody in Europe thought they had a voice in this.
There was a kind of a telling exchange, in fact, that you write about between Edward Montagu, the British Secretary of State for India, and Arthur Balfour. They really didn't think that the Arabs, or the Jews, for that matter, mattered very much.
No, they were very much products of their times, and I think there was one moment, Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, was always amazingly detached, and Edwin Montagu said, we might get trouble and they'll kill each other, and he said, well, they do it anyway, more or less, who cares? And I'm afraid that was the attitude, and they didn't realize the Arabs were going to feel enormously resentful. And, of course, at the same time, as the British and French were quietly dividing up the Middle East between themselves, they were also promising the Arabs, in what was a very misleading way, that if they revolted against the Turks during the war, they would get independent Arab states. And so they were making two sets of promises which weren't compatible. And then they were making a third set of promises to the world's Zionist movement, those Jews who want to go back to the Middle East, that they could have a Jewish homeland. And all those sets of promises really ended up creating awful trouble, which we're still living with today.
Looking at this whole area, first of all, it was all part of the Ottoman Empire, which at the end of the First World War, as the Versailles Treaty was being negotiated, began to be broken up. Again, I think that in modern times we tend to say, well, Lebanon's always been there, Syria's always been there, Iraq's always been there, Iran's always been there. And that's simply not true. There was no separate entity of Lebanon. It was part of what became Syria before these negotiations began.
Well, Lebanon was a sort of province of the Ottoman Empire. But you're right, there was no separate Lebanon as a country, and Syria was a collection of provinces of the Ottoman Empire. Iraq was a collection of provinces of the Ottoman Empire. Iran was a different one. Iran was, in fact, a country in its own right, known as Persia in those days, and it did have a government of its own. It did have a sort of independence, although it was very much under the influence of both the British and the Russians before and during the First World War. But what you were beginning to get in the Middle East, and this was going to, of course, complicate the picture, was you were beginning to get the developments of Arab nationalism. And so what the British thought they were dealing with, and the French thought they were dealing with, was a sort of bunch of Arabs who really didn't have any views of their own. In fact, the Arabs were beginning to develop very, very strong views of their own and beginning to want their own governments.
Well, let's take an example or two from that time. And Iraq, of course, is the one that springs to mind because it's the one that everybody is talking about now. We're introduced to it now as a single entity, but I gather it is at least three separate ethnic groups and religious groups that are combined into one tentative country?
I think, yes, tentative country is a nice way of putting it. I mean, what you had was a province in the north around Mosul, which contained a great many Kurds who are not Arab at all. I mean, they're Muslim, but not Arab. Around Baghdad in the middle, you had, yes, a great many Arabs who were both Sunni and Shia, but you also had significant numbers of Christians, Assyrian Christians, for example, and what used to be quite a significant Jewish population, particularly in Baghdad. Then in the south, again, you had Arabs, again divided between Sunni and Shia, but you also had a lot of Persians, similar to the people who live in Iran. And so you could argue, I think, that Iraq did not have the building blocks of a nation when it was created by the British at the end of the First World War. I mean, it was officially created not by the Treaty of Versailles, but it was created slightly later in 1921. These different parts were thrown together with very little experience of self-government. They were given a king who, in fact, came from outside. King Faisal came from the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. And it's not really surprising that it didn't work terribly well as a country.
So whose idea was it to create this country out of these elements?
Well, it was the idea of the British. The British wanted to make sure that they got hold of what became Iraq because of oil and also because of the routes to India. The British were always concerned to protect India, the jewel in the crown of the British Empire. And they saw Iraq as a very important way station on the way to India, especially as air travel was beginning to develop in the 1920s. And so for both strategic reasons and oil reasons, and I suspect also, and it was always a British motive, to keep the French out. You know, Britain and France may have been allies in the First World War, but that didn't mean they trusted each other. And so for various reasons, the British wanted to control Iraq. They didn't, however, want the expense of running it themselves. I mean, it's very expensive to run a country and be responsible for its government and its roads and its drains and its hospitals and its schools and so on. And so what the British wanted to do was find a nice, compliant Arab ruler who would rule the country on their behalf, on the cheap, and who would receive a little bit of help from the British, but basically wouldn't cost them all that much. And so with Faisal, they thought they had found this, and so they popped him onto the throne in what was really a completely sham sort of election and ceremony, and he became king. And they thought they'd done it rather cleverly. Iraq wasn't going to cost them very much. They had not kept it out of the hands of the French, and they'd protected all their interests there.
You could change a name or two in the paragraph you've just spoken, and it would sound as though it occurred yesterday, wouldn't it?
Well, it does, rather. And I do think, you know, great powers, sometimes I think, suspect that their power may be able to do more than it always can. And I think the British thought, you know, we'll simply create this country, put a king in there, and, you know, with a little bit of management, that should be that. In fact, it never turned out like that. Faisal turned out to be a lot more independent than they had counted on. The Iraqi people, as they now were, turned out to be much less easy to manage, and the British had to deal with revolts all the way through their time there. They tried to deal with them, interestingly enough, by using the new force of air power. I think it was the first time in history that civilian populations had been bombed for the air, and that was when the British did it in the early 1920s in Iraq, and they used it as a weapon to cow the population. And it never turned out to be that easy, and they never really got the sort of government they wanted. And Iraq remained a very unstable country. And this may be what the Americans are going to face in Iraq if they get the regime change that they want, that they may not be able to find an effective government. They may find themselves having to manage it. And that, of course, becomes very difficult. I mean, the British and French wanted to avoid it in their time because you immediately become the target for everyone who doesn't want you there.
Margaret Macmillan is a historian at the University of Toronto and the great-granddaughter of David Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister in 1919. Her book is called Paris, 1919.